the fight against human trafficking in Maine. This week, Preble Street opened a new healing center focused on helping survivors of human trafficking. This may come as a surprise to some people. Maine? Human trafficking? But social workers say labor and sex trafficking is a statewide issue. Caseworkers at Preble Street and other social service organizations say they began focusing on human trafficking more than a decade ago when they started seeing young people arrive at teen centers after escaping perpetrators who were using violence and drugs to force them into sex work or free labor. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss the new healing center and we'll learn about some of the efforts in other parts of Maine to protect vulnerable people, including immigrants, from being exploited. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we're going to look at efforts to combat human trafficking here in Maine and beyond. Joining me, Julie Kesselman, who is Director of Anti-Trafficking Services at Preble Street. Melissa Brennan, who is Supervising Attorney with Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project. And Jean Brueggemann, who is Executive Director of Freedom Network USA. We invite your questions and comments. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you, and thank you for joining us for the hour. Jean Brueggemann, I'm going to start with you, and we're going to start with the national perspective, because that's what you deal with. You know, I think a lot of people, when they think of human trafficking, they might think of some sort of movie they've seen, the Hollywood version of human trafficking, people packed in like sardines into the bottom of a ship or the back of a truck, crossing international borders. Is that what we are mainly seeing in the U.S. or seeing here in Maine? And if not, what is it that you are tracking in your organization?
Yeah, thanks so much. You know, that's a good question, and it's a common challenge. So human trafficking in the United States is it appears in many different ways. We certainly have foreign nationals who are trafficked in the United States, often for labor. In agriculture, in restaurants, in factories, in poultry processing, in gardening, in domestic work, home care services, pretty much more likely in the industries that are less regulated, less oversight, and where worker protections are very weak. And these tend to be industries that were most likely to be performed by formerly enslaved people. And so kind of in the reconstruction era, when we started developing labor protections, there was a conscious decision to leave these industries without protection. And so it's I like to talk about the fact that I think it's important to understand that the human trafficking that we see across industries today is a direct result of the racist history of US labor law and immigration law. So we see immigrants coming in a lot of different ways, sometimes undocumented, sometimes crossing the border intentionally and then getting caught in trafficking situations, sometimes brought by traffickers. Sometimes they're entering on legal visas. Our guest worker visa programs, are designed to allow employers to bring in workers to meet needs that are not currently being met by the U.S. workforce. But workers are often tied to their employer. If the conditions are bad, they're not allowed to find a different job with better conditions. They either have to stick with what they've got or be deported, returned to their home country. And most immigrants who are getting these temporary work visas have paid a recruiter in their home country, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, in order to have the possibility to have their American dream. And then they get here, And sometimes it is, you know, some employers are wonderful and they support their workers and they have a great experience and go home and support their families. But others are trapped in unconscionable circumstances where they're not being paid, they're being abused and exploited, and they feel like they have no options. And then we also have, as if that's not enough, there's also our law sort of separates what's called labor trafficking in all of these different industries, and then sex trafficking. So that's any kind of experience in the commercial sex industry that involves force, fraud, or coercion, or anyone under the age of 18 who's engaged in commercial sex work. And so in that industry, we see much more of a mix between U.S. citizens and foreign nationals, and minors and adults who are being exploited. And generally, the traffickers there are taking advantage of another form of vulnerability. And I know one of the challenges in Maine right now is your really high housing costs and the lack of affordable housing. And that's something that we're struggling with across the United States. When people can't afford housing, they're desperate. They're desperate to make money. And so often they engage in work in conditions that that are dangerous and are find themselves accepting more and more threatening conditions until they find themselves trapped in a situation that they feel that they can't get out of. So it's a real mix.
Yeah. And just to be clear, I think that's one of the questions that comes up. What's the difference between sex trafficking and traditional prostitution? And the line that you draw is if there is force, fraud, coercion, or involves a minor, that is a line where you draw the line between what people might consider traditional prostitution and sex trafficking. And I wanted to ask you, Jean, what is the scale that we're talking about here? How do you measure? How do you figure out how many people are involved in human trafficking in the U.S.? Where do you get your numbers?
Yeah, so you've hit on a real challenge, Jennifer. That's something nationwide that we're still struggling with. The numbers we use at Freedom Network are based on the numbers of trafficking survivors that are members, and we have over 80 members across the United States who are individuals and organizations like Preble Street, who are working with trafficking survivors every day to provide them with the social and legal services they need in order to recover from this crime and this trauma and to rebuild their lives. And so our members report that they're in total serving over 2,000 survivors every year. So that's our members alone. We can also look to every year, the U.S. State Department publishes the Trafficking in Persons Report, and they gather up the data from the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which are the two branches of the federal government that provide the biggest sources of funding for victim services for trafficking victims. And so they publish the number of survivors who have received services through those funding sources. So those numbers we know are definitely the people who have been identified as trafficking victims. But then on top of it, how many people are just suffering in silence, have not found services are not available in their community. That's the tough nut to crack. And frankly, we haven't figured that one out yet.
Well, Jean Brueggemann, thank you so much for joining us. I understand you have to leave us now. Jean Brueggemann, Executive Director of Freedom Network USA. Turning now locally, Melissa Brennan, I will start with you. Jean was talking about how many immigrants are especially vulnerable to exploitation. I'm wondering if you can tell me about some of the specific, of course, without using names, some of the specific cases you've seen here in Maine. Have you seen cases of human trafficking here in our state?
Yes. Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for the question. Absolutely. We work with immigrant victims and survivors of human trafficking at ILAP, the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project, where I work. We serve both victims of labor and sex trafficking. In terms of labor, we have seen non-citizens trafficked in a variety of different industries, including those that Jean just talked about, workers who have been essentially enslaved by their employers in restaurants, in the hospitality industry. Domestic servitude is one of the, I'd say probably the top sector where we've seen these cases in Maine affecting immigrants. And so that includes individuals who have been forced to work in homes, often by an intimate partner or by a member of their own family or extended family. So doing things like housework, cooking, cleaning. We also know that there is trafficking happening in the agricultural sector. Jean spoke a little bit about immigrants who come here on visas that tie them to a particular employer. And there are many of those such workers working in Maine. Those cases can be tougher to uncover for sure. Sometimes the workers are in Maine for just a very short period of time and are very isolated, working on farms and remote locations. But we do know that trafficking is happening in those scenarios. In my time at ILAP, I have seen less sex trafficking cases, but that's not to say that sex trafficking of immigrants is not happening in Maine.
Mm. And I want to turn to you now, Julie, because this week, Preble Street opened a new healing center for trafficking survivors. Tell me who you plan to be serving with that center.
Thanks so much for the question, Jennifer. At our new healing center, which is located in Portland, we are hoping to serve all of our clients, which are all victims of human trafficking in Maine. Our program serves men and women. We serve LGBTQ people. We serve folks regardless of whether they're US citizens or foreign nationals. And we serve survivors of sex and labor trafficking. So we hope to cast a really wide net to bring people in here for services. We've already started to do some of our case management services in this building. But our hope is that over the next couple of months, we can start to scale up and really offer a variety of services and programming for clients in this space, whether that be yoga for survivors, psychoeducational groups, workshops around legal issues and legal protections. We have a lot of ideas about what we kind of want to bring to this space. We also want to make sure we're just doing it in a way that's really safe and intentional amidst the ongoing COVID-19 crisis.
I want to ask you how difficult it is to untangle whether or not someone is indeed a victim of human trafficking. I know that so many of these people are in situations in which there are so many factors. Perhaps there's abuse in their home and they're a runaway. Perhaps there's substance abuse. Perhaps they have made some choices that are not the best choices. How do you figure it out, Julie? How do you figure out, okay, this is a case of trafficking?
Thanks so much. That's such a great question. And I think Melissa could also probably speak to this, but trafficking is incredibly hard to kind of tease out from a lot of other situations that you mentioned, Jennifer. It can sometimes look really similar to domestic violence. It can look really similar to kind of just exploitative labor practices. I think especially in cases of labor trafficking, it can be really hard to tell the difference between an employer who is using kind of unfair or, you know, possibly even, you know, illegal labor practices and someone who's actually trafficking in persons. And when it comes to cases of sex trafficking, a lot of the folks that we work with who have a history of sex trafficking may have also at different times in their life engaged in commercial sex as a means of survival, as a way to get a little bit of money, possibly as a way to help support substance use. It can be really hard to tease out. We are not law enforcement. We're not investigating. We're not trying to get definitive proof or written evidence that trafficking has happened. What we're really looking for is whether someone has been forced to engage in commercial sex or labor through force, fraud, or coercion for the economic gain of someone else. If that has happened, we consider that person right away to be a victim of trafficking, and we open our doors to provide services to them.
And I would note, I'd say one of the big challenges in victim identification is that almost no victims self-identify. No one is ever rarely going to walk into your office and tell you, I am a victim of human trafficking. Trauma is a very big barrier to really teasing out a person's history of trafficking. It's often the very last thing that someone wants to talk about. In my role as an immigration attorney, so often these conversations, you know, the person seeking help may be very focused on what can you do for me, what immigration options are available. I don't want to talk about these painful experiences of my past. As well as, you know, interacting with victims who are under active trafficker control, which is often the reality that someone has not yet managed to escape the situation and is very afraid of what will happen if they start talking about the abuse and exploitation that they're experiencing at their home or in their workplace.
What can you do for them, Julie? How can you, I guess maybe I can turn this around. Can you tell us a story of someone who has come to Preble Street and been able to turn his or her life around?
I think we have lots of clients that we've been able to really help transform their lives. You know, something that we think about a lot is that traffickers, the person who is exploiting someone else, is meeting some basic needs, right? They might be providing that person with shelter. They might be protecting that person's immigration status. They might be providing that person, very concrete form of protection from other people. That might be their source of getting food to eat. Or again, you know, for folks that are engaged in substance use, it might be their source of substance use. So we really have to think about ways that we can connect survivors with those protective factors in other places. Is there other shelter that we can connect someone to so they're not reliant on someone else for a place to stay? Is there food that we can connect people to? Can we help someone get into medication-assisted treatment for substance use disorder so they're not reliant on a trafficker for substances? Especially, you know, amidst the opioid epidemic. So we're really looking for other supports and services that we can connect folks to that can get them that independence and help them build connections and community in other places outside of their trafficking situation. And we have a client who has been with our program since probably 2013, right around when we started. And she has found a lot of success with our program. She doesn't need a ton of support anymore, but she's still with us to check in every once in a while. She has a job. She's in her own apartment. She has a car. She's taking care of her kids on her own. And we have a lot of cases like that where, you know, connecting people with a few things that they need, shelter, food, housing, job opportunities, gives them that freedom that they need to leave their trafficking situation.
We do need to take a quick break. We are talking about human trafficking on Maine Calling. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. If you have a question, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from WEX, providing global fintech solutions for the fleet, travel, and health industries. WEXINC.com.
On the next Speaking in Maine, relocalizing traditional foods.
You can control a lot of your destiny if you can control your food.
Join us for a conversation between Winona LaDuke, Program Director of Honor the Earth, and Sarah Alexander, Executive Director of the Maine Farmers and Gardeners Association. This is the fifth episode of our series featuring this year's Summer Institute at College of the Atlantic.
And you can hear that broadcast this afternoon at 2 p.m. here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is pleased to be a media sponsor of the Collins Center for the Arts Music in Minsky series, Join cellist Zlatibor Fung and pianist Rohan Da Silva as they perform pieces by Beethoven, Liszt, and Grieg live in the Minsky Recital Hall on Sunday afternoon, September 19th. Maine Public members are eligible for 15% off tickets to the performance. For details on the concert and the Maine Public member discount, please visit mainepublic.org and click on Events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the programming, understanding the scope of labor and sex trafficking in Maine and where to turn for help. My guest, Melissa Brennan, who is supervising attorney with Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project. Jean Brueggemann was with us for the beginning of the program, executive director of Freedom Network, and Julie Kesselman, director of anti-trafficking services at Preble Street. Share your comments or questions via email. talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now, Kate Sternsluis, who is program director of Courage Lives, a branch of St. Andre Home. Kate, thanks for giving us a call. And tell me, did I get that right? Is it Courage Lives or Courage Lives?
You did it exactly correctly. It is Courage Lives. Thank you so much for having me on your call today. I appreciate the time.
Well, tell us about St. Andre Home and Courage Lives. What is it that you do?
Sure. I'm so happy to be here and so glad to hear this call is happening and the education is being presented. We Courage Lives is a branch of St. Andre Home. St. Andre Home is started over 80 years ago, around 1940, the Sisters of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, better known as the Good Shepherd Sisters, and they first took in their first unwed pregnant mom in 1940, and since then they've been providing services under their mission to serve women and children in need, strengthen and restore the life of children and families, and promote the individual dignity of everyone who presents to the agency. In 2013, the sisters attended a conference that was put on by the Justice in Action Network on human trafficking, and they were really interested and really wanted to help that population and really wanted to do something. And they were granted a very large grant from the Next Gen Foundation in 2015, and we opened what was at that time called Hope Rising. Courage Lives was initially called Hope Rising, and we are going on our sixth year as a residential home for women who have experienced either human sex trafficking or sexual exploitation. And so we're a 5-bed home. We serve women over the age of 18, and we do not, as I was listening in earlier, we don't have to prove the sex trafficking or exploitation happened. We just need to know that there was something that happened, and doesn't necessarily need to be litigated or anything of that nature, but know that there was an experience and we are here to provide services and support in that part of our program. And we have a separate part of our program that provides outreach services. So we provide services to men and women over the age of 18 in the community. We provide case management, outpatient therapy, and outreach services to survivors of human sex trafficking, labor trafficking, domestic violence, and sexual assault. So we do a lot of great stuff.
And so, Kate, what part of Maine are you in?
We're in Central Maine. We're located in Central Maine. We do a lot of our outreach services in Central Maine. We take referrals for our residential home nationwide, though. So we will take a referral from any place in the country for our residential program.
All right. I was wondering if you could share a story or two of somebody who has come through your program.
Sure. There's so many stories. I'll probably end up kind of combining pieces because they're just all so unique. We have seen women come into our program that, you know, their trauma history is years long and started, you know, sometimes it starts as a young child and they have lived very long lives of homelessness and substance abuse and mental health needs, trauma needs. And they come into the program not knowing what their potential really is. And during their time here, we've seen people complete school. We've seen people go to college. We've seen people get their first job. We've seen people reunite with family. We have seen people get their own first apartment and live independently on their own for the first time, get driver's licenses, just the amount of growth and change that we see, it's amazing. And the amount of change that we see in their ability to see themselves as important and worthy of love and being able to be independent and safe is something we see here every day. And it's what keeps us motivated to keep doing it. But we also see them build connections with each other and build connections within the community. Our residents here become survivor speakers. We have often when I do these presentations, I have one of the survivors with me. I don't have one in with me today, unfortunately, but they become speakers and advocates in the community. So they go out and they do this work with us. And that is just amazing to see them be that next person to educate and promote healing and restoration. So,
well, Kate,
really,
I really appreciate
a really neat process.
Sure, I really appreciate you calling in. Kate Sternsluis is program manager at Courage Lives, which is a branch of St. Andre Home, and she is calling from Central Maine. And we're moving on now to Kara Barneys, who is rural program manager at Safe Voices. Kara, thanks for calling in.
Yes, thank you so much for having me today.
And Safe Voices is...
Oh, hello.
Kara, are you there? Hello, are you there?
I can hear you. I'm here.
Great. Yeah, you serve Androscoggin and Franklin and Oxford counties. Tell us who you serve and about the work that you do.
Yeah, so people may know that Safe Voices has been serving survivors of domestic abuse and violence for 45 years, but what they might not know is that we also support survivors of sex trafficking and sexual exploitation. And so domestic violence and sex trafficking intersect in many ways. And what we've heard from survivors is that oftentimes it is an intimate partner or even a family member who has trafficked and exploited them. Similarly to perpetrators of domestic violence, traffickers will use tactics of power and control to exploit someone's vulnerabilities for their own personal gain.
Give us an example of what you mean by that. And yeah. what do you see happening when you say family members? What do you mean?
So I'll give an example. A trafficker could also be someone's boyfriend. And they may offer a place to stay when she has nowhere else to go. But in order to stay there, he may say she needs to have sex with him or go on a date and give him the money in return. And if she doesn't comply, the abuser will often force or manipulate her into doing what they say. And unfortunately, we have seen also from survivors that family members have exploited people as well in their own families. So that can be really difficult for survivors because in that moment, they do need shelter, food, clothing, whatever need has to be met. And when the trafficker is a loved one who says, you know, I'm looking out for you and I love you, it can be hard to process that it's their boyfriend or friend or even parent who would exploit them.
Let me ask you this, Kara, how do you reach out to people? How do people find your organization?
So people find our organization sometimes through word of mouth. That's really important when we're working with survivors and they have been able to improve their lives through the great work that they do, you know, and conjunction with us. They may tell other people who are in similar situations, hey, I reached out to Safe Voices and they were really able to support me while I found safety, really. It's about the work that they do and we're there to support them throughout their process. But word of mouth through our helpline, we have a 24-hour helpline that people can call and receive advocacy, support with filing protection orders, access to finding shelters. There's a lot of different ways that people can find support through us, but that's two of them.
Well, Kara, thank you so much for calling in. Kara Barneys is a rural program manager at Safe voices. I want to go to some of the questions coming in from the audience. I'm going to go to an email here from Peter. With the issue of trafficking and all the legal snarls, how does Preble Street or others trace things back to the perpetrators? What are the legal consequences for them? Julie, tell me, what do you do? You mentioned earlier that you are not the law, that you are not, this is not your job to determine whether or not there's a legal case, but surely you do call the police when you are working with somebody who comes to you.
Yeah, such a great question. We are really focused on service provision for survivors of trafficking. And so that means we are letting them really take the lead and tell us what it is they want and what they need. We have survivors come to us who are not interested in pursuing legal action against their traffickers. We have folks that come to us and that's super important to them. And if it is, we 100% will facilitate connecting them with law enforcement. You know, we've gone with folks to help file a police report. We're really taking the lead from our survivors, on exactly how they want to handle, if they want any law enforcement, involvement in their case. I think Melissa might have some more information about the legal side of things too. I think we lost Jennifer.
Sorry, Jennifer, can't hear you there.
Ew. Melissa, are you there?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, go ahead. I'm just asking if you have somebody, I understand you could not hear me. If you have someone who comes to you and has a really horrific tale to tell, and you believe that person has been the victim of human trafficking, but does not want to go to the police, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, like Julie, we certainly put the client's voice and preferences front and center, and we would never pressure a client to make a report to law enforcement. Approaching these cases as an immigration attorney, you know, all the while, as I'm hearing my client's trafficking history, I'm counseling them on their immigration options. And the way that federal immigration law is structured, there is a very great incentive to reporting a trafficking experience to law enforcement. There are so many of the trafficking victims who we work with are without legal status or have a temporary or insecure form of legal status in the United States, and so are interested in long-term stability and finding their way to a green card. And so two of the main forms of protection available, there's something called continued presence and another option called a T visa. Both do involve on some level reporting your trafficking to law enforcement. And essentially it's easier to get protection, to get a work permit, to get protection from deportation if you come forward and report what has happened to you to law enforcement. And so that's a process that we are often a part of. But again, the victim, the survivor is the one who gets to call those shots and decide if it's something they want to do. And we are fortunate to have some good law enforcement partners locally who are very aware of the dynamics of trafficking, aware of the fear that immigrant victims carry with them, and understand why it might be a very difficult process.
All right, we'll go to a call now. We'll go to Joanne, who is calling from Harrison. Hi, Joanne, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you very much for this program. I'm a former emergency department nurse. Oftentimes, nurses are the first link to helping someone that comes in that's been abused physically. I went to a program in Portland 2 years ago, put on by a woman who was actually trafficked for many years. She's now working with the Boston FBI and Cumberland County. Her nonprofit is called StopTraffickingUs.org. She's based in Standish, but I believe she goes all over the state. Her number is on their website, StopTrafficking.org. She had a number of presenters, from psychologists to the FBI agent locally. They work really very closely together. Also, I contribute to a group in Lewiston called New Beginnings that I thought was very impressive in terms of helping teens that are in need.
So, Joanne, I wanted to ask you, and thank you for your advocacy. As an emergency room nurse, have you had personal experience with people who have come into the emergency room and told you about being controlled by others and using the emergency room as a way to escape that control?
Well, first of all nurses in that setting are obligated, almost on a Good Samaritan law type of rule, we're obligated as practitioners at any level to report any type of abuse that's verbalized to us or that we observe, you know, someone coming in repeatedly or frequently or maybe with injuries that look obviously inflicted. But in terms of there have been one or two that I suspected, but, you know, nurses are people that are trusted. And they're often, but unfortunately, when you're in an emergency department, you don't get to spend a great deal of time with each person. So it takes a while to establish rapport for something like that. So personally, no, but there have been a couple of times that I've mentioned it to supervisors that to flag it because it was a concern to me. But it's like reporting child abuse. You have to be very careful. I mean, there are many types of situations where it's overly reported and it puts a parent at risk. But oftentimes, you know, we get prostitutes, you know, a lot of people in difficult situations. And so we are a source that the public should know that a nurse will always be confidential, but they are required to report it as well.
Joanne, thanks so much for calling in and sharing the resources that you are aware of. We are talking about human trafficking in Maine. If you would like to join the conversation, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Patriot Subaru in Saco, gearing up for fall adventures with the all-wheel symmetrical drive Subaru. PatriotSubaru.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In small towns and big cities throughout our country, thousands of people are starting over. They're refugees who have made it out of Afghanistan. We'll head to Los Angeles to check in on efforts to welcome Afghan refugees. That's next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us here now, upcoming shortly at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. Thinking about donating your used vehicle to Maine Public? Well, now's a great time, especially if you plan to replace it. When you donate a vehicle to Maine Public during the months of September and October, our friends at Lee Auto Malls will provide you with a $500 Lee Thank You Reward for use towards the purchase of a new or used vehicle at any Lee Auto Malls 19 locations throughout Maine. For complete details, please visit mainepublic.org, and thank you as donated cars, trucks, and SUVs make it possible for us to do more here at your public radio station.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're discussing how to identify and help those who may be the victims of labor or sex trafficking. With me, Melissa Brennan of the Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project Maine and Julie Kesselman with Preble Street. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Julie, let me ask you what those of us who are living our daily lives might look out for, how we might see signs that someone is being exploited.
That's such a great question, Jennifer, and something that we cover a lot when we provide training on this issue to healthcare professionals, behavioral healthcare professionals, other social service providers. There's not just one indicator of human trafficking, but there are a few things that we like to tell people to kind of keep an eye out for. If someone comes to you for services or someone in your personal life has a partner that seems really controlling, that seems to kind of always be present for that person, they don't have a lot of freedom of movement outside of maybe this other person who seems very controlling, that would be a big red flag. Someone who's really socially isolated, someone who doesn't have a ton of freedom of movement, maybe outside of their home or apartment or their small community. I also like to lift up the issue of substance use. Substance use in and of itself is not an indicator of trafficking, but substance use is a huge vulnerability for trafficking. We have a lot of survivors that we're working with right now who have a history of substance use disorder, especially opioid use. So if someone is kind of closely linked again to a controlling partner and there's substance use involved, that would definitely be a red flag or an indicator for me that, not that trafficking is certainly happening, but that I'd want to maybe get a little bit more information or see if there might be some supports I could provide. For young people, I would say if you are working with a young person or you're in contact with a young person who's maybe under the age of 18 and they're spending time with a much older adult, or there's a much older adult in their life who seems to have kind of an inappropriate connection to them, that would be a big red flag or indicator for me right away. Those are just a couple of things that I'd want people to keep in mind and kind of keep an eye out for. If you see something that sort of, I like to say, doesn't really pass the smell test, you see something that looks suspicious, you're not sure what's happening, or maybe you're at a hotel or a restaurant and you just feel like maybe you're seeing the same staff there all day, every day, the working conditions look really weird or scary to you, you can always reach out to the National Human Trafficking Hotline and provide a tip to them. The tip can be completely anonymous, but you can give some information to the hotline, and that tip gets then sent directly to me and our local law enforcement partners to follow up. So if you are somewhere or if you know someone that is in a situation that you think is kind of potentially risky, really encourage people to make a referral to the National Human Trafficking Hotline. That will, again, come through to our local law enforcement partners. It will come to us here at Preble Street Anti-Trafficking Services. It'll go to the Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault Hotlines for immediate response. And if it turns out that there's no trafficking happening and that it, you know, is not, the situation is not actually unsafe, you've at least been able to make that report and know that it went to the right people to look into.
All right. And I just found that number. It's 1-888-373-7888. And I'll just post that onto our Facebook page as well. Melissa, what would you like to add to what Julie has said?
In terms of what Julie has said about, you know, red flags and identifying trafficking cases, I would absolutely agree. There's no one sign with immigrant victims. Very often, lack of access to a person's own identity documents, to their passport, can be a big red flag because frequently traffickers will confiscate those documents as a means of control. Someone who seems particularly fearful without explanation, like Julie said, sometimes it's just something that doesn't add up where something seems off. In addition, people who are observed to be working extremely long hours, that can be an obvious indicator. And as Julie mentioned before, it can be difficult at times to figure out, you know, where do you draw the line between bad working conditions and a workplace that's just simply exploitative and what crosses the line into trafficking. And that's, you know, oftentimes that's not going to be clear, but we still want people to, you know, to reach out and seek help when they observe these situations, because whether it's trafficking or whether it's a severe form of workplace exploitation that doesn't rise to the level of trafficking under the legal definition, there are still all sorts of help available, immigration legal help at ILAP for non-citizen victims, as well as the many different comprehensive services provided by Preble Street and other social service partners across the state.
An email here from Martha. Can you talk about the intersection between human trafficking and sex trafficking in the child welfare system? What can caseworkers, foster parents, and other child welfare resources do to work in concert with the organizations represented on the call? What are the challenges? Julie.
Oh, that is such an important question. We work with a lot of minor victims of trafficking. And we know sort of globally across the country that a lot of victims of human trafficking and many victims of sex trafficking have a history in the child welfare system. Children that are sort of at the age of transition from the child welfare system into the adult services system are particularly vulnerable because they may have grown up in a system where they were living in out-of-home care, either in foster care, or maybe in group home or congregate care. And while a lot of work has been done to kind of ease the transition from those placements into adulthood, a lot of times young people are still kind of aging out of foster care at the age of 18, 19, 20, without a lot of resources, options, or familial support. And that makes them particularly vulnerable to traffickers who are really smart and know how to take advantage of that vulnerability and offer an opportunity to work or to perform sex work in exchange for a place to live, for some money, for food. And I think what child welfare professionals and parents can and should do is just do your best to prepare that young person for the real world. Make sure that they're getting as many education resources as they can, helping them build up a community and good connections and a good support system so that they're not relying on someone that they shouldn't be relying on for support. Helping make sure that they're ready to, you know, maybe enter the workforce or enter college, giving them really good, healthy, safe options will mean that they don't have to turn to a trafficker for those options. I think it's really important.
Melissa Brennan, I'd like to know if you can tell us a story about somebody that has come to your attention and you've helped.
Sure. Well, one particular client who we are actively working with right now and have been serving for a few years is a client who it's really been incredible seeing her journey and how she has transformed her own life. She's originally from a South Asian country and came to the United States on a visa, hired to work for a wealthy family. Believed that she would be paid fairly and that she would have acceptable and humane hours and living and working conditions, only to find that she was forced to work, incredibly, incredibly long hours, early in the morning until very late at night, doing domestic work, cooking, cleaning, taking care of everything in the home. Eventually her situation came to light and law enforcement got involved and liberated her from the situation, which is how she got connected to ILAP. We helped to, and she is a victim who was very motivated to participate in the legal process and to see that her traffickers were held accountable for what they had done to her. We helped her to testify before a grand jury and to cooperate with law enforcement in seeking justice on her behalf. We helped her to secure initially a temporary work permit, and eventually helped her to apply for something known as a T visa, which gives foreign-born victims of human trafficking 4 years of legal status and work authorization in the United States, and eventually provides a pathway to a green card. So we helped her to secure the T visa, and she now has a pending application for a green card. She's also worked with Preble Street Anti-Trafficking Services, they've provided her with a lot of support. She now has a stable job, has stable housing, and is incredibly grateful for all of the support that she's been given. She's feeling so good about her own financial situation right now. She was recently sharing with us how she gives back to a charity in her own home country, trying to lift young people there out of poverty, because it was poverty in the first place that led her to seek employment overseas. So really a nice, almost at the happy ending with the green card in hand.
We have an email here from Sue. Hello to all of our sister agencies. It is so important for us to begin the serious business of reframing how we look at sex trafficking. Let us re-examine what we perceive and mean, for example, by, quote, prostitute. We also need to understand the complex comorbidity that often accompanies exploitation and trafficking. These include incarceration, substance use, and PTSD. It is high time for policy changes and a deeper, more humanistic approach to understanding this global reality. And that's Sue Kingsland, who's executive director for the Center for Women's Wisdom's Women in Sophia's House in Lewiston, Maine. Julie.
Hi, Sue. Nice to hear from you. It's such a good point. I think that for a long time, a lot of folks looked at trafficking in sort of a silo, as like an isolated thing that happened to people, and didn't look at it as part of this larger picture of failed systems. And that's really what trafficking is. And that's what Sue is getting at. Trafficking doesn't occur on an island by itself. It occurs amidst a sea of really challenging policies, challenging immigration policies, like some of what Melissa has been talking about, policies around foster care and youth aging out of care, policies around criminalization and criminal history, things that make it harder for folks to get jobs if they have a criminal history, or harder to get apartments if they have a criminal history. So when we look at treating the issue, if you want to say it like that, treating the issue of human trafficking, we really have to look at these policy changes and ways that we can make sure that folks who have experienced human trafficking can leave their trafficking situation and not re-enter it, but also ways that we can stop trafficking from happening in the first place.
An email here from Tim. We are a small Maine-based business partner in the National Center on Safe, Supportive Learning Environments funded by the U.S. Department of Education. We have supported the department's efforts to address human trafficking with educators over the past several years. Our work has included updating a comprehensive guide for schools, as well as producing a series of webinars related to both labor and sex trafficking designed for educators. And he's with Vision Training Associates. And what strikes me about Tim's email, Melissa, and what you just said, Julie, is how this is a very interconnected issue that somebody who's working with a group focused on vision training is also working on trafficking.
Absolutely. It's a cross-cutting issue, you know, affecting, I mean, anyone can be a victim of human trafficking. My focus is on non-citizens, but it just as anyone can be a victim of a crime. It's a cross-cutting issue, and the needs of victims and survivors are, you know, incredibly varied. And so it really takes a wide network of service providers and professionals and a community to lift up victims and survivors and help them to build safe and stable lives for themselves.
Well, thank you both for joining us for this hour. You just heard from Melissa Brennan, supervising attorney at Immigrant Legal Advocacy Project Maine. Also with us, Julie Kesselman, director of anti-trafficking services at Preble Street. Today's sound engineer, KG Akimoladun. Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn produce Maine Calling. Today's program will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. Tomorrow on the program, we will look at the boxing scene in Maine, the amateur boxing scene in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.